It's Keith Tomasek, and you're listening to The Inadequate Life, a podcast about the creative process and people whose lives depend upon it. On today's show, writer Mark Rayner. Mark writes kind of bizarre, twisted, and very funny fiction. You're going to hear all about his writing process, working with publishers, and working as a self-publisher. That's right, Mark has taken the dive into the digital world of self-publishing. He's worked with regular publishers in the past, but found that he had some more control and more ability to get his work out into the hands of his readers working as a self-publisher. So we talk about that. We also talk about his creative process and the intersection of his life as a teacher and a writer. That's all coming up. But first, as always, I have to say thank you so much to Karen Hartwick over at Stratford Tea Leaves. You know, stratfordtealeaves.com. Look it up. Karen's a sponsor of the show. I'm tipping a little classic tongue ting. It's a beautiful, gentle tea. I had some with Lionel, who designed my website the other day. Lionel's much more of a tea aficionado than I am. He loved it. I'm really liking it. And it's from a region in Taiwan. Karen went out to the Alishan Mountains in Taiwan. And very high up on the mountains, the tea comes from the mountains. And it's very, as I said, just soft, a gentle tea. And Karen came back from Taiwan, recommended it to me. She knows the types of tea that I like. And I'm loving this stuff. It's a really special kind of tea. And by the way, if you've got someone on your Christmas list who's out of town, perfect. Just visit Karen Hartwick's StratfordTeaLeaves.com online. Look up some teas. Give her a call. She'll put together a little package of tea, stick it in the mail. Boom. There's your Christmas gift taken care of. And you don't even have to go anywhere or do anything. Just sit at home and talk on the phone to Karen. Anyway, great opportunity to get some wonderful Christmas teas for your friend. That's visit StratfordTeaLeaves.com. Well, it's Christmas time. Last year at this time, Cole and I did a little podcast that's going to come up. We've seen two family shows in the region here, Shrek the Musical, which stars Steve Ross from the Stratford Festival. And we also saw The Little Mermaid with Bethany Kovarik, who also, like Steve, did a podcast. Bethany is the dance captain in The Little Mermaid. And it was a beautiful production over at Drayton Entertainment. The sets and the costumes, fabulous. And apparently they shared those with the Rainbow Stage in Winnipeg. So if you saw The Little Mermaid in Winnipeg, you will have a sense of just how beautiful it was. But first, speaking of Winnipeg, actually, I got an email, not from Winnipeg, but from someone, a guest on the show. Joanna Stein is originally from Winnipeg. And if you heard the episode, her and I met in Winnipeg at the Fringe Festival there many, many years ago. Here's an email from someone in Toronto. Dear Keith, I'm a new mother. I listen to the podcast in the wee hours when nobody is awake but me and my baby. That's so sweet. That used to be me and Cole, actually. I love the podcast with Joanna Stein, who created that mom head video with her GoPro camera. I bought her book, and I'm loving it. I heard she's from Canada but lives in the United States. I'd love to meet her sometime. Do you know if she's ever coming to Toronto? Thanks, Jody. Well, Jody, thank you very much for the email. Joanna was just in Winnipeg, so that doesn't help you. I'm just, sharing the love. But I did ask her after I got the email, and she said she doesn't have plans to be in Toronto right now, but her publisher would like her to be there. So she's working on the sitcom. You know, if you listen to the podcast, you'll hear how the video she made led to a CBS sitcom pilot. And she does expect that she'll have some free time in the new year, January, February, and might be in Toronto to promote her book then. So I'll let you know. I'll let you know either way if she makes it in January. But thanks for sending me the email. If you want to send an email, just visit theinadequatelife.com and say hello. And there's a form you can fill out there. You can also leave a voicemail message. That would be really cool too. So on to Mark Rayner. If you are a big reader and you want a copy of his book, I'm giving away a copy of one of his books, The Frigularity. Just visit theinadequatelife.com, that's my website, /Mark. theinadequatelife.com/Mark. You can enter a contest to win a copy of The Frigularity, which you'll hear all about in the podcast. And Mark has offered to autograph the book just for you. So enter the contest. What have you got to lose? And I'll, we'll mail it to you. I say I, because I told him I'd pay for the shipping. It's a thick book. And if you're really interested in reading more of his funny stuff, Mark and I teamed up to offer you an exclusive promo code. That's right. It's a deal. It's Christmas, So you'll get some great savings on his books if you just visit theinadequatelife.com/Mark. That's it. So here comes the interview. Thanks again for spending so much time with me. If you enjoy the podcast, please tell one of your friends or share it out on social media. And the conversation with Mark and I, which happened very early in the morning, begins with us talking about breakfast. And I believe I was confused about his breakfast of strawberries and eggs. Here it goes. Chopped up some strawberries. And that's what I had.
Put strawberries in with? No, aft
on the side, yeah. That would be weird. That would be weird even for me.
That's a great place to start because we are recording. I'll have to keep that in.
Yeah, I don't think I could handle strawberries in my omelet, my cheddar cheese omelet.
Right, no. Although, you never know. So, Mark Rayner, welcome to my living room. You're the first person to have a podcast in my... Usually, I go to people's homes, but I didn't want to impose on you.
Oh, you could have. It wouldn't have been as tidy or as nice as this, though.
Well, that's my job around the house, Mark. It's, we'll have to talk about that some other time. I did spend an hour cleaning up before you got here. So, hey, we both teach at Western. I don't know, the folks... I talked to my audience a little bit about the fact that I teach at Western, but I don't tell them the fact that I'm a contract worker, so I don't really have permanence. I've been there 7 years. How long have you been at Western?
I've been teaching at Western this is my 14th year.
Wow, that's a long
time. I am a contract worker as well, though.
Same as me. Yeah.
Same as you.
But as well as doing that, you have been writing for how long?
I've been writing seriously for just a little bit longer. I started writing seriously probably 98, 97, around there.
And do you remember the first time you thought, hey, I can get actually money for writing, any kind of writing? Because you're obviously, you're a fiction writer, but...
Because I worked in journalism first, right. So that was a writing of a kind. And that's actually why I went into journalism, was because I thought, oh, I could, make a living writing there and then do some writing on the side, my fiction writing on the side. So I thought that was going to be a good way to make a living.
Yeah.
No.
Too much writing all at once?
I had a newspaper job and I was working 8 to 5 hours, that kind of thing. And writing probably, I worked it out at one point, 10,000 words a week or something.
Wow.
For the newspaper.
Publishing. Oh, for the newspaper.
And then I was coming home and writing probably another 4,000 or 5,000 words a week on my first novel. So it is possible to do that. Now, I didn't have any other form of life.
That's what I was going to ask about, yeah.
No girlfriend, no hobbies of any kind. That's all I was doing was writing, and that was clearly not going to be sustainable. But I learned pretty quickly that I wasn't really a journalist at heart. I would go to something and be covering it and think, oh, wouldn't it be cool if like a robot walked in? Or what if that guy was actually an alien? Not that he's not an alien. He seems like an alien.
Right.
So, yeah, I realized I wasn't really a journalist at heart. I was more interested in thinking about what ifs and thinking about sort of the bigger picture of what was going on and really wanting to make fun of it.
Absolutely.
As a way to distance.
As opposed to the mundane act of reporting.
And reporting, let's face it, a lot of reporting is quotidian.
That's a great word for it.
And just boring as hell.
No, we're at the end of the semester and a student who was a progressive thinker in our group... emailed me, and he did this amazing web project, and he's a progressive thinker. He did some investigative, he scraped some data, and he came to some conclusions based on that. And he emailed me, he says, I had two job interviews, and I don't think I fit in these places. And I said to him, well, look at the reporting that they're doing. It's not the kind of stuff you are doing. Right now, if he's not at Vice, I don't know where a guy like that goes in Canada. But so I can totally see how as doing the daily quotidian reporting things would have been boring to you, and you had the your imagination you were able to use at night.
Yeah, I would go on a little. Well, I mean, I would do it while I was covering stuff too. I'd go on a little mental safari, and
one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is because I've had a couple of musicians on the show who have raised money on social media, and they can now sell their wares on social media. Lee Siegel and Chris Patterson. Lee Siegel's with Stratford. He was on Broadway. Chris Patterson with The Arrogant Worm, their distribution model has changed radically over the last year. And then Melanie Doan is a musician. She's doing the same thing. She's not with a label anymore. And as an author, you've gone through a couple of things because you have been with a publisher and you've also self-published. Is that right?
Yeah. So my first two novels were published by publishers, small publishers. And so those were independent presses as well, but they were publishers. Yeah. So that was sort of the usual... model for an author, which is the author writes the book, then he sells the rights to a publisher. The publisher helps him or her publish the story, and you give up quite a bit when you do that. But you gain quite a bit too, because you don't have to pay someone to edit the book.
Oh, that's nice.
You don't have to pay someone to design the cover. And
right.
Presumably the publisher is going to do some marketing as well and help you sell the book. So I've done that. And then what happened was my second publisher, who published Marvelous Harry, basically went out of business. He decided to stop publishing just because it's such a brutal business. And so I thought, you know, rather than give all my rights back, because I got all the rights back when he went under. I made sure that was going to be in the contract when I signed the contract. So I got all the rights back. Cause rather than give my rights away again, I'm going to hold on to my rights and I'm going to publish this thing myself. And that was much more, and actually I sold way more copies of the book.
Just doing it on yourself.
Because I could control everything.
Right. And when you say sell, was that online sales or actually physical?
Physically selling them in online.
That's amazing.
So it was a good experiment, and it was a good sort of proof of concept for me that it's possible to publish on your own and sell copies.
And would that have been before the Kindle or just around the time that was being introduced?
It was around 2009. So the Kindle did exist.
Yeah.
So what I did with that one was I published the print version first.
Yeah.
Then I did a podcast.
Oh wow, that's pretty cool.
So I think it's still available on iTunes. It's free.
Yeah.
So I podcast the thing, and that actually got me a fair amount of interest.
The podcast. Again, you were ahead of your time with that.
Yeah, and but I wasn't an early adopter. I was ahead of my time, but not ahead enough that I got
Street cred from being way ahead.
Exactly. Yeah. People are trying all kinds of things. Some things are successful, some things aren't.
Yeah.
It's a crazy time.
And Goodreads is a power. Now, you introduced me to Goodreads. I'm not familiar with it, but it's basically the place where people who are looking for Goodreads go, and then folks can leave their own ratings, and there's a whole ranking system.
Yeah.
And there's I just checked out your Goodreads page. So the Amadeus Net ranks highest of all your books on Goodreads.
It's funny, yeah.
In terms of the average, 4.5 is the out of 5 stars, which is pretty great. And then, so after that was Marvelous Harry, a novel in 5 fractals.
Yeah.
And then Pirate Therapy,
which is a collection of short stuff, yeah.
And then Frigularity. So I want to just read one of the, I was on Goodreads looking at what people were saying about your books, and they did great stuff up there. And this is what someone said about Frigularity, which is too thick for me to get through, I have to warn you.
Yeah, I've heard that complaint, that it's too long.
I'm not complaining. I'm just being honest. It's not, it's just an him mother thick book. It's intimidating. I look at it and I go, I don't even know where to start. I do know where to start.
It's the beginning. You start at the
beginning. I did. Trust me.
Traditional. You start at the beginning. Though one of my friends who helped me proof it, he proofed it backwards.
Really?
He's a maniac.
That is kind of weird.
What a great guy, though.
Yeah.
Because it's a great way to proof.
That's fascinating.
To go backwards, because then you're not engaged with the story. You're just looking at the text.
All right, so this is what someone said about Frigularity, and I love this, what she wrote. I have to say that I love Douglas Adams' books, which is one of the reasons I love The Frigularity. It reads much the same, with little side thoughts here and there that make me think Zaphod Beeblebrox will walk out of the pages and explain everything. That's a wonderful compliment.
That is, yeah. That's pretty high praise.
Yeah.
Douglas Adams, that's pretty high praise.
And that's the style of writing. I mean, I got into it because I worked, so it's set in a sort of an office with young, sort of cool people who were sort of avant-garde in the tech world. And when I worked at AOL, I worked with America Online around 2000, the turn of the century. And it was that same kind of vibe. And there was the male-female sexual tension that you tap into, and the sort of the hierarchy of the characters in the office. You know, where does that, how'd you tap into that? So, because you don't get that from the university, do you? How'd you
Not
tap
really,
into
no.
that?
No. I don't know.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Well, I guess, I mean, I modeled it after an advertising agency.
Right.
And so one of my jobs after I decided I wasn't really a journalist was a marketing guy. So it's just from observation, basically.
Okay.
But I never worked at a place like that myself.
But that's what you do. You take those observations. And when we started out, you talked about your crazy imagination. And a friend of mine who has young kids, she said, if you have kids, you might have heard of The Regular Show. It's a show, a young people's TV show. And she said the writing on that, it sort of combines intellectual smarts with the adventurous sense of humor that you have. You know, you've got those intellectual smarts in your writing. It almost feels to me a little bit like Monty Python, but more grounded. But it has that absurd quality to it, I would say. But, and there's that also that adventurous thing where you kind of, like you said, oh, I wonder if that was a robot. You're always thinking, what if? You know, that's what I was thinking.
What if this happened?
Yeah. Now, where did that come from? Did you grow up in an environment when you were a kid where you weren't allowed to think out of the box like that? I'm just making this up as I go along here.
I actually don't know how that happened. I think I've always had it.
Yeah.
But I'll talk about my mother. My mother tells me a story. She felt so guilty for so many years because at one point when I was a little kid, I don't even remember this. Apparently I was just a chatterbox.
Sure.
And telling stories all the time.
Yeah.
And at one point she said, she got, you know, as mothers do, she's, shut up. That's enough already. Stop with the craziness. It's insane.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just stopped telling stories.
Really?
Till I was, you know, late teens, early 20s. So maybe what happened was it just got bottled up for so long.
Oh, okay.
That it just kind of morphed and did something inside me. And really since I went to university, I've had this kind of twisted storytelling thing happening in my head.
So going back to social media, when I looked you up online, there was a link to use social media. Well, you're active on Twitter, active on Facebook. So the big thing on Twitter, the mistake a lot of people make that have something to sell is that they use Twitter to constantly just, you know, talk about their junk that they have to sell.
Yeah, no, I don't do that.
No, exactly. That's exactly. So how often would you say, what percentage do you actually say, hey, by the way, sign up for my newsletter, by the way, to convert your Twitter followers to newsletter followers? Because that's an important thing.
Probably not as much as I should.
Well, that's not a bad thing, though. They say that's better. If you're interested in, you know, being a real human being on social media.
Yeah, that's sort of what I'm trying to do, is just be
social.
A human being. Yeah. I mean, basically, I try to sell something when there's something new.
Oh, that's interesting.
That I want them to know about.
And you've also done special offers, too, which I think is cool.
I have, yeah.
On Kindle, you've offered access a piece of work for 99 cents, is that
right? Yeah, I've done that. I've tried that. I say tried because these things don't necessarily...
it's experiments. You know, that's how we learn.
I've tried that. The one thing that actually did work fairly well, and I haven't done it again, but just because it's a lot of work, is I ran a contest where people could, if they bought the book, then I would put them in a draw to win the next book.
Yeah.
And the grand winner was going to be Tuckerized. So Tuckerization is a science fiction thing, but it's basically writing somebody into
the book.
Into the book, yeah. So there's two characters in the Fragility that were winners of this contest.
Oh, wow, that's great.
Yeah.
And now is that addressed anywhere in the book at all? Do you mention that? Oh, so it's just cool.
It's just a cool thing that,
that's a great idea. So I
will do that again, but I haven't done it. It's a fair amount of work and...
But it pays off because you all of a sudden get a lot of sales, and there's an incentive to pick up the sale. And I know you've ranked really high in the Amazon satire chart. Is that right?
Yeah, I've been up in the top 10 there.
Yeah,
I've never cracked the top 10 in any more general sense.
Sure.
So, and I think that's what you have to do really to get the benefit of the algorithm.
And what do you think it was that drove you up into the top 10 of the satire? Was it the reviews more or the social activity?
I got to be honest. I don't think it's anything I've done.
Well, that's interesting.
Specifically. Yeah. I think some of the general things work.
Mm-hmm.
So like being on Twitter and I have a pretty good following and really nice people that follow me on Twitter. And so they'll promote stuff for me sometimes. Yeah, yeah. I think that has an impact. And I think generally speaking, just being out there providing content will work and help build your audience. And then you just get these spikes where people will suddenly buy something. So it did happen that when I had the new book, I got up there a few times.
Right.
Just because
there's so much activity around the one thing.
Yeah.
And Google rewards content. You know, Google and even Google and Facebook, the word is they both reward content. In other words, if on Facebook you put out a Facebook post that says, please share this or please like this, the algorithm recognizes that you're begging for a share or a like and gives that particular activity less weight than an organic like or share where someone just does it on their own.
Yeah.
And Google, you know, you mentioned podcasting and you mentioned all the different social media. Google, when it's creeping you and searching you, sees you in all these different places, it kind of recognizes, hey, this guy's for real, he's not just trying to sell something. So it sounds like the Amazon algorithms, which we know nothing about, might be sort of similar to
that. We soon sort of know generally how they work, but we don't know. They're kind of black boxes, and that's good because otherwise people will manipulate
them. And the other thing you did in social media that impressed me, and I took a long time for me to do this, and it's going to sound silly, but it took a long time for me to put up a photo of myself. Like, I had my Twitter avatar there. It was just Festival Reviews, the name of my website. And I waited and waited, and everything, you know, people want to deal with people. They don't want to deal with businesses.
Yeah.
So I finally found a photo that I liked, someone took of me, and I put that up there. And I felt really comfortable, finally. But I'm a private guy. And then I was just in Stratford a while ago in a bar, just writing in the back of the bar, and some guy comes up to me, it was hilarious. He goes, "Hey, Keith." And I'm looking at him, and he knew that I didn't know who he was, and he goes, "It's me." And I'm like, and then he told me that he knew me on Facebook. And I'd conversed with the guy, and yeah. I conversed with the guy's mother. And then I realized, oh, okay, it's you. But you did that. You've done that as well. Like, you put yourself out there in a real open and honest kind of way.
Yeah, I've been, my policy has been, well, what I tell my students, which is don't put something out on the net. Don't put something digitally into a digital format that you are not comfortable with the rest of the world seeing.
Right.
So if you're thinking about taking that naked selfie,
just
realize that that's a digital file that could escape the confines of your phone and anybody could see it.
Oh, for sure. Forget about a naked selfie. Have you put up a selfie?
I did when I was doing Movember.
Okay, and then the reason I ask is because I learned from our students. Like, so I teach a social media class, and selfies are the rage, right? Rage a while ago. And I'm like, I've never put up a selfie. I had a former student come in to talk to my students, and she took a selfie while the students were talking to her. So she's actually being addressed, and she's taking a selfie. And I'm like, I guess that's just the way it goes now.
Yeah. Is that Lauren O'Neill?
All the students know that what she's doing, and they've all done it, so it's okay to take a selfie while someone's, I'm taking a picture. So I thought, oh, I got to put a selfie up. So I put a selfie up the other day online, and someone, funny, a guy older than us, like a guy says, oh, I saw your selfie.
How dare you, sir?
But the funny thing was, it wasn't even, I had to fake it because I couldn't take the selfie that I wanted to take. So I got little 7-year-old Cole to take a picture, and I held my hand out like I was taking a selfie.
That's awesome.
I just felt like I was cheating, but I couldn't take a selfie. I am so old. I can't even take a selfie by myself.
Well, it's a lot easier to do now when you got a camera that has a phone that has a camera on both sides.
The other thing I'm talking about revealing is I'm telling people more than I have Crohn's disease. I've had it since I was 16. I haven't talked about it online much, and this is the first time. I mentioned it on the podcast from time to time. But I think I'm kind of testing the waters about my own comfort level about going somewhere.
I'm
going
to have to face that with my next book for sure.
How so?
Well, my next book is a satire about the obesity epidemic.
Okay.
And I have struggled with my weight
my entire
life.
To look at you, I would never think, now so we go from talking about selfies to weight problems.
Yeah. So it's the same kind of issue.
But I've known you for like 10 years-ish. I never would have guessed you had a weight problem per se.
So that's definitely one of the things I'm going to have to get somewhat more comfortable about.
Is this the most personal confrontation you've had in your creative process? Or have you ever delved so deep into your personal life and your creative work?
This is the one that's had the biggest struggle I've had with, because I had the idea for this novel about 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And I've tried to write it twice before. And because I've had this sort of, issue with weight my whole life, it's been really hard to be funny about it. Because a lot of the jokes just come out as bitter. So if I'm, joking about trying to lose that last 5 pounds or whatever it is, it just comes out as bitter rather than funny, because I'm just, I've been struggling with it.
And are you letting someone else look at that and saying this is bitter? Are you worried?
This is all self-censorship, of course.
Yeah, be careful, because that might be the best stuff.
No,
because it's honest.
I think I've been doing it long enough to recognize when something's funny and when it's not funny.
Oh, okay.
I think I can tell the difference.
But so I'm interested in the process of here. So we're getting into the creative process. I'm interested in the process of revealing yourself and then being able to judge what it is, how it's coming off. That's a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
Especially if you haven't really gone that deep before.
That's true. Yeah. And I've touched on these kinds of really personal issues. I mean, one of the things that I do with writing characters is really a lot of my characters come from personal experience.
Right.
Even when they're people that are nothing like me, I still try to...
So it's a facet of
imagine,
something.
Imagine, right. Who that person is. So it's part imagination, and then it's part... Because I can't make up emotions.
Right.
I can only call in the emotions I've had. So I will pull something. It's the same way an actor would. They'd have those sense memories and
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So same sort of thing happens in that part of the process for me.
So you're really editing yourself. You're not having someone else look at the stuff
at this stage. Yeah, I'm not ready for it to be. But I mean, I know it's funny. I mean, I think I've been doing it long enough now that I can recognize when something's funny, and I can recognize when I'm just doing something cheesy. Like I'm just like, okay, so I'm using a formula here to make a laugh, and it's like, okay, is that really an organic?
Yeah.
Or is it one that I've just sort of inserted and tried to lay
material.
In. And I'm trying to do less and less of that. So I've been, you know, I want people to have fun reading the books, and it's hard writing comedy, as you know. So I think before, maybe Marvelous Harry has a bit more shtick in it.
Oh, okay.
Right? Yeah. Like, so if you read Marvelous Harry, I mean, it's still funny, but it's shtick.
Yeah.
And The Frigilarity has a lot less of that. And it's actually got a lot more really serious moments in it, too.
Yeah. So the transition. And then
the book I'm working on now has even less shtick
and
more serious. And I think that's kind of an interesting progression that I'm going through, because the laughs I think are a bit more organic,
which is great. That's what
that's what you want.
And what's your writing process? Because you have a full time gig, you have a life.
Yeah, I try to write every day.
And do you tend to write in the morning, in the evening?
I'm totally useless in the morning.
Oh.
I can teach in the morning,
sure.
So that's why I try to schedule my classes in the morning, because the energy from the students, even if they're half asleep, engages me enough that it gets me going. So I tend to write in the afternoons and the evenings. And a good day is if I can get 1,000 words written, that's a good day.
And then the next day, do you read those back and edit, or you just keep moving forward?
Yeah, move forward. Yeah, I've learned that if because I did that with the Amadeus Net, which is why it took me like 3 years to write, because I would write one, write, and then go back and then reread what I've written and then start working on it and polishing it. And it's like, and then that's no good, because what happens is you need to have a rough, or I do, I need to have a rough draft.
The whole thing,
so that I know what the story is. I can see what the whole thing is, because parts of those pieces of those, I'm just not going to use.
Right.
I'm going to take out. So there's no point in crafting it and making it beautiful and perfect if you're just going to pull it out later.
Right.
So I'm better off, and I should keep wanting to say I'm, because I don't want to say what the process should be for anybody else. So write the whole thing, then go back and start to do the crafting.
And have you read my favorite book on writing? Is actually called On Writing by Stephen King. It's a fabulous.
Oh, I've read that, yeah.
Yeah, it's great. When I was in the Middle East, I used to listen to it as an audio book when I drive. I had a 2-hour commute from Abu Dhabi to Dubai, so I put that on the car stereo. I just loved it, because it's actually Stephen King reading his own sort of biography about writing.
Do you believe it, though? I mean, I like the autobiography part of that book the most, because that was, for me, I don't know, kind of cool just to think, if Stephen King was a struggling writer.
Struggling, he had nothing, and then he gets a call about
Carrie. He got damn lucky, holy cow.
Yeah.
But still,
yeah.
I mean, he was working for it.
So what do you mean, the fact that he's kind of a medium channel?
No, the writing part, the writing rules.
Oh, closing the door.
Yeah, because the book is sort of like, the first part is sort of about his autobiography, and then he sort of gets into his rules for writing.
Yeah.
And one of his rules is, you know, he cuts 15% of his manuscripts at the end.
Yeah.
I'm like, I read The Stand, Stephen, and I don't believe you. I think you're lying to me.
That's funny. Yeah, I don't know.
Because the writer's cut that came out a few years later was even longer than the original. So.
That's funny. Well, imagine if he does, how much he... But he does talk about his... I love the whole closing the door thing, going in your space, and just sort of being a medium for the story to come out and just let it flow. And he has a big thing for regular schedules, and it's...
It's
fascinating.
I really aspire to have a more regular writing schedule.
It is a discipline,
And I think if I was doing it as a living, I would do that,
of course.
I'd have to.
Well, here's the thing.
I'm not doing it as a living.
And do you ever think that maybe if you were doing as a living, that would take it to the next level?
I think so,
How do you wrestle with those demons?
I don't know. I mean, I that'd be a nice problem to have.
But that's, it's not a choice you feel comfortable making, though.
Well, I'm not in a position to make that decision at this point.
Well, we all are.
Clearly not.
It's just a question of, do we want to keep our houses?
Exactly.
Do we want to have a car?
I like my comforts too much. I want my house. I want my car.
Well, that's what Nicholas Campbell, the Canadian actor who actually studied at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts with Sir Laurence Olivier, he said that when he was a kid, after studying at Queen's and coming back, he realizes, I don't want to have a parachute, because I'm just going to use it. So he decided never to get a civilian job.
Yeah.
And that's one of the questions I often ask people is, have you had a civilian job? And I'm amazed at the amount of people that I've interviewed on the podcast who are successful, who've almost never had a civilian job. They all were like right out of school. They just said they volunteered, they starved or whatever. People who lived like students until they were 30 or 40 and then all of a sudden just got a whack of cash because they got their first project.
Yeah,
that's a whole thing.
Yeah, I guess ultimately I'm too middle class for that.
Now, did you get any pressure? Did you ever say to your parents, like, maybe I'm just going to be a writer? And just because that's the other thing that all those people have, is they did have a lot of support from their families.
Yeah, no,
to pursue
I had pressure the other way. I mean,
right.
I don't think my parents would be upset to hear me say that, but I think it's true that it's like, you should have something to fall back on.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So like, have a plan B.
Which is what I got too.
Yeah. So like, that's what I mean. I'm too middle class to not have a plan B. But I did have a brief period there where I was really close to making the decision to go.
Huh.
To
just, the dark side.
To go for it.
To live on the muse.
Yeah. To live with my muse. That was why. So I couldn't find a job in journalism. It was 92. It was a bad recession.
Hard time. Yeah.
Not a job that I wanted anyway. Like, sure. They offered me a job at Tilsonburg for like
easy Tilsonburg
$200 a week or something.
A lot of tobacco. You know what you get in Tilsonburg? Good tequila.
Oh, okay.
They bring it in because of the tobacco pickers.
Of course, yeah.
So you can drive for miles and not get a bottle of tequila on here in Tilsonburg.
So anyway, I said, well, screw this. I'm going to go live in Prague.
Oh, nice.
I read it was really cheap.
Cheap to live there.
So yeah. I had enough money to live there. So I lived in Prague for a year, and I had a play produced.
Oh, that's
so
great.
So I wrote a play and had that produced there, and I started noodling around with Marvelous Harry.
Yeah.
My work gig was a journalism job, but it was barely journalism.
Right.
It was working for the Czech National Radio Service, the English language service. Yeah. And my job, I had a radio column.
Okay.
It was called Observer, and my job was to go around the city and just observe things that were funny and unusual.
So more in simpatico with your creative process.
Exactly. And so that year for me was really cool. And like, I want to be a writer of fiction and fictional stuff, not journalism.
Yeah. But you never were able to just quite go to that.
And I couldn't quite go the next step.
The middle class. And
I was hanging out with a bunch of other writers and actors, and there was some discussion amongst us that maybe we should just go to New York and try to make a go of it there.
Yeah. Because it's not expensive to live there or anything.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I just can't imagine where we would have been living.
You know, the other thing I get from the people that I talk to who have succeeded is that they get the support from their families and in the community. So they tend to stay in that community. Like Louise Petrie, who's, you know, she's been on Broadway. She's won all kinds of awards. She created the role in Mamma Mia of the mother. And she broke out of London, and it was the London theater community here and the work at Western when she was in that faculty that really gave her the legs that supported her later on when she went to Toronto, you know? But it was making even that move from London to Toronto. So the advice would be anyway. So do you know any people who at this point in our lives make that transition?
That decide to...
Yeah, and then have success. Leave the middle class straight job and then... Maybe they take an early retirement.
I don't know Kelly Armstrong well enough to know what she was doing before she got successful, but she writes some supernatural fiction. And she had a regular life, and now she's sort of transitioned into just being this international popular writer.
Wow.
So I think it can happen.
Yeah.
I think if you keep plugging away and working at it, it can happen.
Words, you got to up your limit there.
So I just got to, you know... keep the focus on producing, and it really is about producing. I think if any kind of art, you've got to be working.
And then have you got an editor to give it to?
I've got a few editors I can use, and I'm just trying to debate. My big decision now is: do I want to try and traditionally publish this book, or just go self-publishing again? This is one that I think has a big enough potential audience that a traditional publisher might want it.
And if you self-publish, how much do you invest in actually physically printing copies? Or is it all Amazon?
That's all POD, so that's a print on demand. So you don't have to pay up front for the printing side.
And what is it? So print on demand, if Amazon, you get the book. How do you get the book into the Amazon world?
Amazon, I use CreateSpace to get to Amazon. And then for all the other bookstores, I use a company called Lightning Source, which is an Ingram company. So that gets it into libraries and...
And then the print, and they all work with the print on demand model.
Yeah, and they use the print on demand
model. So you don't get involved in that once.
So I don't have to do anything about that. I just have to design the book.
Right.
So I have to design the cover and design the guts of the book, and I send the files to those people, and they print them when they get an order. But the vast majority of my sales are digital. They're e-copies, so Kindle, Kobo.
And is your margin better on those anyway?
Yeah.
Well, that's congratulations for tapping into that world, the digital print world, the digital marketing world. Within 2000, you never even would have...
I mean, even 2005, I don't think I would have considered self-publishing.
Yeah. Well, hopefully next year Canada Reads will be talking about Mark Rayner's
book. That would be nice.
Well, we'll watch
it. Hey, it happened to Terry Fallis.
Of course. He did the podcasting.
He did the podcasting
thing. Didn't
his
book get turned down?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, all these people are... And that's the thing is, like, the traditional publishers, I mean, God bless them. They've got lots of people sending them books, and they don't know what's going to be... popular and what's not going to be popular. So they turned down all kinds of great stuff.
Yeah.
So his books got turned down and he podcasted it. Then he said, and he got enough positive response from that he thought, I'll publish it. So he self-published.
Right.
And, you know, he had a box of them in the trunk of his car and he would sell them that way. And then he thought, well, I'll send it to I think he's, it was
the Leacock Awards.
The Leacock Awards. Yeah. And he won the Leacock Award.
Yeah, pretty big deal.
Which is a big deal. Really big deal. And then from there, a mainstream publisher said, oh, I guess maybe we'll, maybe if it wins the Leacock Award, maybe it's worth publishing. And then as if that was enough of a horseshoe, he won Canada Reads.
Right.
His book won Canada Reads, which was huge. Cause that's, I think that's like 100,000 sales or something.
Just automatically like that. From that. Yeah. Now, but the nice thing about that story is he didn't give up. That's the other thing. When I talk to people who have succeeded, you know, at the end of the day, they do believe in themselves far enough.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
The community supports them, and you just go, okay, well, the publisher doesn't want it. I'll just do a podcast.
And that's sort of I'm still on that I'm not giving up stage.
Yeah, yeah.
And it really is still about the work.
Yes.
Like the important thing is that you've got to be true to yourself in the sense of not giving up on the work. You know, sometimes I don't feel very successful because I haven't had like a Terry Fallis kind of thing. But on some days when I read, like for example, a review on Goodreads,
like from Stranger,
or there's some of the reviews are great because the reviewer has just they absolutely get it.
Yeah,
they get everything that I'm trying to say, and it's like, wow, I've connected with another human being on a really deep level, and that's kind of. That's cool.
So, and the fatness, if that's what it's called.
Well, we'll see. Maybe we'll that's see. The title.
And way to go. It's a huge testament to your development as an artist that you're willing to tackle something so personal to you, I think.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it is. It's a hard one to write about, but there are moments of laugh out loud humor so far.
Oh, good. Yeah. I can't wait.
And that's how I know it's funny. If it makes me laugh out loud,
yeah.
Like there's one scene in The Frigilarity that I'll have to do is think about it and I start to giggle.
Oh, that's great though.
Yeah.
So. All right. Well, thanks for doing this.
So people want to find me, they can find me at markarainer.com.
Right. On Twitter, Mark A. Rainer.
Mark A. Rainer.
All right. Thanks, Mark. Well, there you go. Mr. Mark Rainer has left the house, literally and figuratively speaking. You know, his house, he's got a beautiful, talking about the fatness and his weight problem, a beautiful little gym set up there in the house. He really takes care of himself. It's amazing. And it's, you know, New Year's. So if you're thinking about a New Year's resolution, be inspired. Take a cue from Mark and maybe, you know, in the new year, pick up The Fatness when it comes out. I'll make sure to let you know on Twitter. Hey, thanks so much for listening. I appreciate your spending the time with us right now. If you haven't already, do me a huge favor and share the love, spread the word on iTunes. It's the best way this podcast gets listened to and gets picked up in algorithms and search engines. If you just go to the iTunes store and type in theinadequatelife.com. It'll take you to the podcast page. And up on the left-hand side, you'll see a little button, ratings and reviews. It's as easy as just hitting 1, 2, 3, 4, or five stars. Or you can leave a little review. I don't understand why Keith is always talking about himself on the podcast. Whatever you want to say. And I must say thanks to the folks who have left ratings and reviews. I just checked it the other day and was pleasantly surprised that the number is growing. So, iTunes.com, The Inadequate Life. Don't forget the deals. If you're going to visit theinadequatelife.com/Mark, we're giving away a copy of The Frigularity, and Mark's put together a great offer, a special promo code for his books. So that's a great treat yourself over the Christmas holidays to one of his fabulous books. I'm Keith Tomasek. Thanks so much for listening. See you next time on The Inadequate Life.